Welcome to MGO Podcast 9.19. This is a really good podcast because Ace and I just kept putting on different accessories during it. I know you can't see that, but you'll have to trust us. Ace, do you know how much effort it takes for me to not call you the last handbender every time we start a podcast?
I assume it's considerable.
Like every time. Like I did it once and I'm like, I shouldn't do it again. And I never do it. And it's just every time it is in my head, the last handbender. I'm sorry.
Well, I made the maybe slight misstep of posting a series of increasingly desperate text messages I received from CVS, but they use my real name.
Yes.
So, which I guess many people still don't realize that my name is Harry and not Ace on my birth certificate, but somebody responded, Harry and the Ann Bendersons, and I'm done. I'm done.
I mean, it does make the nickname extremely understandable.
You know, yeah.
I've been looking at baby names.
Yeah. I mean, Harry's pretty old school.
I can tell you that, like, I know the exact shape of the Harry curve, and it bodes unwell for you. So, Ace is... anyway, basketball happened. Wait, no. First, I'm going to talk about our sponsors, our lovely sponsors.
Very professional podcast.
Dave is overjoyed that I didn't forget it. You know, we put it in like the third.
He's raising the roof.
We would like to thank our sponsors, Underground Printing, The Bow Store, The Residence Inn, Ann Arbor Downtown, Homeshare Lending, Peak Wealth Management, the Alumni Association of the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor Elder Law, Lantana Hummus, Human Element, Ecotelligent Homes, and Michigan Law Grad. So onward. Michigan finishes off its regular season with two road wins over top 50 KenPom teams.
Yes.
Penn State is not a quadrant one win because they screwed both themselves and the conference with their typically weak non-conference schedule.
Mm-hmm.
So they entered the Michigan game number 78 and dropped to 85 afterwards. Unfortunate because Penn State was like 25 in KenPom.
Yes.
And so I didn't even look. I was just like, they're fine.
And it turns out not so much.
And Penn State loses Mike Watkins early in this game, which they probably could not afford.
No, they lose all the games when they don't have Mike Watson available for most of it.
But I thought even with Watson out there, the way that Penn State attacked Michigan made absolutely no sense. They're posting up Watkins, and Watkins is a good shooter. He's a 70% shooter from the floor, but 80% of those are assisted.
Yes.
So he's not a guy who goes and gets his own shot. He tried to get his own shot. Didn't go so well. They had their backups, who are not Mike Watkins, try the same stuff.
Like, Julian Moore taking four shots was not what they need.
It's like they watched Michigan's games against Happ and Haas and thought, oh, we can do that. They could not do that.
No, you're Penn State.
And then
you have Tony Carr. That's clearly how you should be attacking.
But Tony Carr in the first half has Xavier Simpson in his face.
Inside his shirt, actually.
And it reminded me a lot of the game where Yogi Ferrell got stuck on Nick Stauskas. And Nick Stauskas was like,
What do I do with this gnat?
What is going on? I can't get past this guy. And if I try to raise up, he's in my shorts. So that was a really effective matchup. Something that we kind of questioned going in. We're like, okay, this is...
Yeah, because we haven't had like an oversized lead guard against Simpson with that kind of skill this year.
And worked out great. Michigan goes in with a sizable lead at the half. Was it 8? Something like that?
Something like that.
And then they have their somewhat trademark, extraordinarily depressing scoring drought early in the second half.
We do these things every once in a while.
But Mo Wagner hits back-to-back threes to pull Michigan out of it. And that first Mo Wagner three... I can't tell you that this is a rational opinion, but it felt like a swing from a win to a loss, even though that just tied the game.
Yeah. No, I do put some stock into the whole, like, swing of momentum when you hit a three like that to kind of bring things back in, especially with Wagner and just kind of how he gets on a roll.
Well, and there's also 3 seconds on the shot clock, and Michigan got him a decent shot, but...
But he's still bailing out of possession.
Yeah, he's got to get that up, and the closeout is okay, and I was, you know... When it went up, I was like, please go down. It did go down That and Jordan Poole and Duncan Robinson.
That duo, that was kind of their breakout, is just like I think I've called Jordan Poole a breakout player.
The amount of effort I spend calling you something other than the last hand bender is like your constant struggle not just to say the word pool in every sentence.
It's literally every sentence at this point. But like it ties into how well Luke Jaklic has engineered this defense to cover up for some obvious deficiencies among Michigan's players. But right now, like, Michigan can afford to play Robinson and Poole both 25 minutes or 30 minutes as they did in this Penn State game. Robinson played 32, Poole played 26 because they're holding their own on defense. And then you put both of those guys out there at the same time on offense, and that talk about spreading the floor, especially when Fogler's out there too. I don't know how you defend that.
And neither did Penn State. Michigan manages to pull it out, in part because they went to a zone with Poole and Robinson out there.
Yes.
In the first couple possessions, it looked a little wonky.
It was really wide the way they were doing it. It was very spread out, and it seemed like it was just asking for Tony Carr to get layups. And then,
well, they shut down Carr pretty well, but Lamar Stevens
was doing a good job of getting in the middle of that zone and picking it apart.
So he's a plus two-point jumper guy.
Yeah.
He got a wide-open elbow jumper, and I was like, I don't really know about this.
And he had three assists in this game, and I think probably at least two of them were against that zone.
But Michigan constricts, and then the next time Stevens has that opportunity, he turns around and Mars in his face, so he can't just raise up and hit a comfortable jumper. And Michigan manages to rotate out of the situation and not give up a bunch of threes from the perimeter. Where else do threes come from? but they managed to not give up a bunch of threes, and they shut down the kind of Carr explosion that was threatening in the first part of that second half.
Indeed. And it's a really nice changeup, especially since, you know, Michigan's not going to be able to play Xavier Simpson 40 minutes a game, or at least they're not going to want to do that. And when you don't have him out there as your, like, primary point guard stopper, that's a great curveball to be able to throw in there that's probably better suited for Jaron Simmons than having him try to imitate Xavier Simpson.
Yeah, and Carr did kind of figure out a couple of things against Simpson early in the second.
Yeah, I mean, he started to realize that he could just rise up over
him.
He's
a foot taller than the dude.
Yeah.
He's like, all right, well, if I drive, this guy's not going to be able to affect my shot.
Yeah.
So, like the point guard on Stauskas' gambit, you know, something that was effective for a while and was adapted to, and then Michigan had another level on defense.
Yes. That's really been the most remarkable thing this year. Watching this team is the multiple in-game adjustments that they have made on defense this year.
Well, and you were looking at synergy stats that kind of paint a picture of what Michigan wants to allow and why they want to allow it.
Yeah, I mean, they've basically just moneyballed the heck out of their defense to the point where they are funneling a ton of opponent possessions into the types of plays that do not produce efficient offense. And it becomes especially stark when you look at, like, how Michigan's offense creates shots and how efficient they are at them versus how their opponents do it. Way more of Michigan's possessions end up in spot-up attempts than their opponents, which generally are, I mean, those are the open threes for the most part. And not only does Michigan get way more of them, they've adapted the strategy where they really are refusing to help off of shooters in a way that they're going to let, like, a pick-and-roll ball handler try to get a contested layup instead of helping down on him. And so opponents are in the 10th percentile in spot-up shots.
Like,
so they're already limiting one of the most effective ways of getting points.
That's quality, not quantity.
Yeah, and that's just the that's not including the frequency. That is just points per possession. Michigan gets 1.07 points per possession on their spot-up shots, not including any rebounds that happen after that. Opponents are at 0.86. That is a massive gap.
And then the thing that also kind of jumped out at me is Michigan funnels a bunch of looks into the post.
Yes. Opponents are at like 11% of their possessions take place in the post, and even though...
And Michigan is terrible
Michigan's
at post
bad
defense.
They're in the 15th percentile in post defense, but it doesn't matter because post possessions are so much less efficient than most other types of possessions that works out just fine. If opponents want to try to keep up with Michigan, using post-ups or even just score an average number of points the way they do. I mean, like we saw with Penn State, you rarely have a team with even one viable post-up threat, and it's tough to find two.
Even Ethan Happ. Like, how many shots did Ethan Happ take to get his, like, 25
points? I mean, I'm pretty sure that dude is shooting below 50% from the field this year.
Happ?
Yeah.
I think he's a little bit above that.
It might be below that in Big Ten play. Yeah. I've been looking mostly at conference-only numbers. But, it's just, you know, the post is a tough place to score. You can't get 3 points from there unless you get fouled. Big men tend not to be great free throw shooters. There's a lot of reason why it makes sense to funnel plays to the post. And Michigan is forcing a lot of post-ups, a lot of isolation. They're staying at home.
They did play Rutgers once, though, so that might...
That helps a little bit. But, you know, most teams have played a Rutgers-ish team.
But not Rutgers.
Maybe not Rutgers specific. Nobody's faced Corey Sanders. But Corey Sanders isn't entirely responsible for opponents using, like, almost 9% of their possessions in isolation. You know, he's, like, 50% responsible. But they make life really hard. They stay home on almost everything. So in addition to, like, opponents are not very good at being efficient on spot ups, they're also very low efficiency on putbacks because Michigan is staying home on their rebounding and boxing out really well. And that leads to being able to contest the offensive rebounds that happen against
them. And then you combine that with kind of the high level, we don't need synergy for the stats, where Michigan is a very good defensive rebounding team.
Yes.
And they don't allow many threes to go up. You have to score 2 points at a time against Michigan, and there's not a whole lot that's not contested now. So.
Yeah. No, I mean, we've talked about the three-point shot gap that Michigan opens up on these teams and the general possession gap now that they've become this really good defensive rebounding team. And now, in addition to all that, they've really focused their defense to the point where, like, they're even in the half court forcing you to be this really inefficient team.
And then the other thing that really leapt off the page was transition.
Their transition defense is...
Michigan is the best transition defense in the team in the country by a mile.
Yeah, it's mind-boggling looking at the numbers, to be honest. Among high major teams, they are second in transition points per possession. There are only four high major teams that allow less than 0.9 points per possession in transition. Michigan's at 0.85.
So a transition shot is a terrible shot against Michigan.
A transition shot against Michigan is actually worse than a half-court shot, which is unbelievable because Michigan's half-court defense is above average right now.
And these are synergy numbers, right?
These are synergy numbers.
So, like, I go to Hoop Math a lot, and Hoop Math is just looking at a box score. Someone has actually charted the synergy numbers.
Yes, yes. So this is all someone's gone over every shot and knows exactly where they came from, what a real fast break chance looks like, what a mid-range jumper looks like compared to a layup, and all that other stuff. But the most incredible thing with this defense is not just that they're incredibly good at the actual transition defense itself. They are the best team among high majors and fifth among all Division I teams at preventing transition chances in the first place.
Right, which maybe they should allow some more.
I mean, I assume the fact that they allow so few affects the nature of those transition opportunities.
That was a joke.
I know you're joking.
I was joking.
When you look at the other three teams that allow fewer than 0.9 points per possession on transition, they are 182nd, 271st, and 345th out of the 351 D1 teams in terms of transition possessions allowed. So they're good at transition defense, but they're still giving up those opportunities on a much more regular basis.
And this synergizes with Michigan's newfound ability to play excellent half-court defense. So they've always been very focused on getting back and not allowing transition.
Yeah.
Now
their defense is set. Like always,
but now this is actually hard to, like, get points against.
Yes,
so, I mean, that's how you get up to the top 20 in defense when you're playing Duncan Robinson and Mo Wagner for a long period.
They're
of time.
11th on KenPom right now.
11th.
11th. It's like Beeline's previous best defense was Richmond in 2002.
I think his best defense here was 35th.
37th.
37th.
Yeah, Richmond was 34th.
I like how I just got that wrong, and Ace was like, no, I know this.
I was just looking at it, like, yeah, for the post right before I came in.
So I was a little worried when Billy Donlan left after one season after he had...
Oh, crap. It was 30.
No, oh, you wait. Were wrong.
No, never mind. It was 37. I am right. It was 2013, 37.
You can't do that to me.
Sorry.
All right.
They did it twice.
I had hope. Anyway, but I was a little worried when Billy Donlan left after one season because he had, in the second half of that year, really kind of gotten Michigan locked in. They didn't give up many threes.
Yeah. I mean, he really started the... change in approach that we're seeing right now. Yaklich has added a lot of stuff on
right.
top
it,
of it, but
it,
Donlan very much laid the foundation.
And it took a while for that to kick in. So like,
there was also a lot of really crappy 3-point luck last year that was masking some of it.
I definitely remember in January last year being like, they brought this guy in as the defensive coordinator, and it's not really working.
There was like a run of like opponents shooting like 50% on
threes. The Maverick Morton game
was that
and
was
then pretty they gave up like 90 or something to Nebraska to win.
Yeah, so but there, yeah, I mean, there were also terrible defensive.
Maybe games. That was a wake up call. Maybe that was a point at which Beeline was like, all right, I need to actually delegate a little bit more to my defensive coordinator.
Yeah.
And Michigan improves a lot at the end of that year. And I was like, all right, now we can really see where this goes.
And then Donlan goes.
And Donlan leaves. And then I'm like, oh. So what does he do? He goes and he gets the defensive coordinator-ish type guy from Illinois State, who is 27-5 last year and really should
play way over their head. Yeah.
Yeah. And so twice in a row, he's gone and gotten a team that has mid-major talent, doesn't have, you know, Anthony Davis out there.
Yeah.
But still plays really excellent defense. Like, Wright State was very good on defense relative to their talent level under Donlan.
Yes.
And then the Redbirds were also. So, and that makes so much sense.
Yeah. Like, I mean, and now we're going to get to see what taking those principles and then putting in, like, Power 5 level athletes, like, 4- and 5-star level athletes. Can
I'm not
do
even.
With that.
I'm not even like. I'm just like you. You can go and run good defense with Duncan Robinson on the floor. That opens up all kinds of stuff for your offense because it's like I don't have to like worry about putting a guy who was in D3 for a reason.
Yeah.
On the floor. So, you know, like if Michigan can just like maintain this level of defense, if it's not based on the fact that Z is an all conference level defender, even if he doesn't get the award.
More on that later.
More on that later. And then they can, like, add, you know, Iggy and Johns and DeJulius.
Like, yeah, when you start looking at, like, the athleticism they're bringing, or, like, and when Teske becomes the featured center.
Yeah.
Like, man, that's going to be a defensive team to be reckoned with.
I mean, I'm not even talking, I mean, like, they maintain this.
Yeah.
With some better athletes and just maintain.
And I both fully agree with you and think they're going to do better than just maintain.
And then if you have this kind of defense with a typical Beeline offense.
We're starting to talk about Final Four territory.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why everyone's super excited about next year already.
Yeah.
Like, half the questions for my mailbag are about next year already. Yeah.
Because I keep doing it. So I'm like, well, Michigan's going to be a 5 seed. They're going to be like a 5 seed. And we're like talking about, well, what about next year?
Yeah. Yeah, we're already moving past. And like, this is a team that can make a run.
Yeah. Speaking of a team that looks like a Final Four team, the Maryland game.
Woo.
So Michigan goes up 30 thanks to Glasses Mar.
He can't. Yeah, he's got to wear those.
He's like in...
He might have to add an accessory for
it. Suthatron like came up with the Photoshop where he's got the novelty glasses and the cowboy hat.
The floaties.
The clock around his neck.
Yes, the clock should be next. Yeah. And so we might have some jewelry regulations on that. We'll see how that goes. But
I bet they have not specifically banned clocks around your neck.
Doubtful. I bet they did not think to do that.
The Flava Flav rule. Yeah. Little known fact, Flava Flav ran on the court and played 20 minutes for Boston College back in the 80s. So they had to make a rule. You can't play with a clock around your deck. Little known.
Little known.
Wouldn't have picked Boston College, but that was what I picked. So the second half of this Maryland game is just KenPom time the whole time, and I don't really know if you can take a whole lot from it.
No.
The one thing I want to take from it is that the fact that Charles Matthews had a couple of nice moves.
Scored all of his points in that half.
Put the spin on Kevin Herter, got a really nice layup, hit a couple of threes, had a couple of turnovers, but we're going to let those go.
You know.
And had 11 points and looked like someone who didn't want to die on a basketball court.
Which was key, because that's kind of been the error of Charles Matthews recently.
If you were Charles Matthews and
this was how
it, this was how it was going.
Yeah,
like,
I would look similarly.
So having him get a little bit of confidence back in his shot, I think it was important. I'm hoping we see a little bit more of that in the opener of the Big Ten tournament.
Yeah. Yeah, I almost don't mind that they slip to that five seed and we'll get that kind of warm-up game, I would expect.
Yeah, Iowa's a little scary, but...
But they don't play any defense.
Yeah, we'll probably have like 30 transition points against them. But the first half, obviously, the big takeaway was Marr, who had 41% usage.
Yeah.
Didn't look it up. I just said that was his largest usage of his career.
I did look it up for the... that's how I think I threw it in the Slack chat, actually.
Someone tweeted at me. He had 28% twice.
Yeah. So, yeah, he had never cracked 30, and then he went 41.
And he's pulling up when Michigan switches on him. He's getting to the basket.
When Maryland switches on him.
Yeah, that's what, sorry.
Yeah.
And, you know, I wrote that column about like how it feels like if Michigan is going to do something in the postseason, you're going to need to see Marr take over a game much more than he has in the past. I'm like, if you could do that in the tournament, that'd be good.
Yeah, the way he was running the high screen, I think we're overlooking in this game, but to a certain extent, he dishes out 7 assists and only has 2 turnovers.
And only 2 turnovers.
Which for Marr is catastrophic. But
that dropped him from like 2nd to 7th.
He has 6 turnovers in the last 2 games. We're not talking about this, but it's like doubling his turnover rate probably. But
it actually went up by like a significant
considerably.
Amount.
but if that's the trade-off to get, you know, fire-breathing Marr, I think we'll all take 1 or 2 turnovers a game for the extra 15, 20 points and 7 assists.
Yeah.
For him to go 6 of 13 on threes, have some of those be off the dribble. That's some of the exciting, like the real exciting stuff was that some of that looked like Derek Walton running the high screen last year.
Yeah. And you couldn't do that, switch everything to Derek Walton, cause he'd just be like, lol.
Yeah. Like, all right, here's a big man. I'm going to murder him.
Yeah.
And we've seen a little bit of that from Poole too. There's
Well, he had that like kind of double jab step. And
which
then,
was beautiful. That gif is getting some traction among like basketball players who are just like, I'm putting that in my bag of tricks.
Well, yeah, he's...
Because the dribble in the midst of that second jab step is not... Like, that's a really unusual move that I haven't seen. And it also made it it's a great way to get your shooting form set. Because the ball's coming right back up to where you can get your hands right on it.
Well,
so
and
he
it,
fired quick off of that.
And it makes that jab step even more convincing because
ball going on the ground and you're taking a step back. Especially since Poole's got a very fast first step that you absolutely have to respect. There's another part of the mailbag that may go into some player comps that are pretty much all lottery picks. So let's enjoy Jordan Poole while we can, people. He's like the only guy on the entire top 100 who's getting only like bench minutes. It's crazy.
He's on the DX top 100.
No, not in the DX top 100. No, in this top 100 of the stat parameters that I used in this mailbag thing.
Gotcha.
But like Bradley Beal shows up quite early. James Harden shows up on this list. Like,
James Harden?
Yes. It's of like players who have produced this level of offensive efficiency while using this usage in conference play in a high major conference.
As a freshman. Yeah.
It is a list of lottery picks and great college basketball players. So we might maybe it's good that Beeline was really reticent to just unleash Poole. He's got,
you know, why he's struggled to get minutes from time to time. Cause he has
there are many factors that probably make Poole's circumstances different than a lot of the other guys on this list. But like, here are some of the names in the top 10 when you're going for this. Jamal Murray, Ben McLemore, Etuan Moore, Alec Burks, Malik Monk, D'Angelo Russell, Jared Bayless, Bradley Beal. All in the top 10.
Okay. And where's Poole, though?
Poole is third on this list.
He's third?
In O rating. And his usage is at 23. It's higher than McLemore, who was at number 2 on this list. Number 1 is Murray.
You need percent of assisted buckets. That's what you need on that list, too.
Yeah, I mean, there's more stuff that, you know, it was tough to...
We've talked long enough about Jordan Poole.
But Poole is
awesome. We need to talk about something else.
Do we?
Yes.
Do we?
You want to talk about Jaron Simmons?
I do. There we go. That'll get me off pool briefly.
I feel like I just stabbed you with
ever so briefly. Yeah.
Ha ha. You have been struck palpably. Anyway, go ahead.
Simmons goes into the Maryland game and gets 7 points in 9 minutes of play. Looks like he is comfortable on both ends of the floor. His role has generally been increasing lately.
He takes another kind of pull-up three, like he hit one earlier. Kind of a bad situation. Michigan finds himself in another one. He hits it.
Yeah.
That's what he did at Ohio. So, hopefully he can add a little bit of that bad shot making.
And he has, a strong layup in transition.
Yeah.
Gets an assist, doesn't turn the ball over. So it really does seem like, he's played – he only played 4 minutes in the Penn State game, but he's played nine or more minutes in four of the last five. And he's, clearly above Eli Brooks, who got a stint, as in the KenPom mirror. Time. And, Simmons is clearly the
also
better option right now.
The second half.
Yeah. it's the second half. Simmons looks viable out there. He's no longer making as many mistakes on defense that I think was a pretty big reason why.
Well, and he's got a handle. He looked like he had no idea what he was doing when he was playing early in the year, because it's like you walk into the B-line offense. Like, how many times has
especially when your offense before was here's the ball, go
right? how many times has a B-line point guard had a quantum leap from year one to year two?
Yeah, or even like a mid-season breakout when things click. We've seen that too.
And we're not going to get a year two out of Simmons, which is kind of unfortunate.
Yeah,
but it's nice to see that he's picking it up and hopefully can give Michigan some good minutes in the postseason.
Yeah, yeah, it is really too bad that he's not one of those graduate in three, play two grad transfers.
I'm just glad that he's getting some minutes now, because to transfer to Michigan and then you're all right, nobody on this team can play point guard. I'm going to be the point guard, and then to get completely axed from the lineup midseason.
Yeah,
after being the man at Ohio. I just want him get in the NCAA tournament, have a good game as a reserve guard, and just kind of check off that bucket list item.
Yeah, it'd be really nice to see that, because I'm sure there are a lot of guys who, if they were in the same situation, would not have handled it the same way that Simmons did.
Yeah. And the other thing that kind of leapt out at me from the Maryland game is that John Teske had probably a 4 or 5 minute period of rim protection in the first half, where he didn't pick up any box score stats, but he altered 3-4 Maryland shots and turned them from what looked like good opportunities into desperate whacks at the rim. And I want Mo Wagner to come back next year, but I'm not going to be too stressed if John Teske is playing 30 minutes.
Yeah, you'll get a defensive upgrade and an offensive downgrade there, and it won't be quite – I think the bigger downgrade will be from, forcing some guy into the backup minutes who's not Teske level. I like Austin Davis.
Davis had a couple of moments at the end of the Maryland game that I thought were pretty good.
Yeah.
He had a putback. He had a couple of good challenges. And, people are like, oh, we got to get rid of this guy, move on, and we're going to go with Castles. And it's like, no, Davis is a great pickup because of this.
Yeah.
Because, he's not ready yet. He had a redshirt year. He never, ever gave up on a big.
Yeah.
Graham Brown.
You hold those guys. Back to your point.
Jordan Morgan. Morgan played 30 minutes as a redshirt freshman. Bad example.
Back to your point on Teske and his defense in this game. He faces 13 Maryland possessions. Maryland scores 0.85 points per possession while shooting 2 for 9 on twos. And they hit some threes that are not Teske's fault, that keeps their efficiency from going completely under.
Yeah.
But that's an impact. And he's also shown – I was also excited by I think it was in the Penn State game. He has had a couple impressive catch and finishes off of pick and rolls recently, where he looks more comfortable.
Yeah, it's something we haven't really seen a whole lot of in the offense this year.
But I think he's got good hands, from what I can tell. I think he's got very he catches the ball well. It also shows up on defense with his ability to get steals.
Yeah,
and that guy doesn't need to do much to dunk. So we've seen him finish a little softer than we probably would have liked sometimes this year, but there have been a couple plays recently where he has finished with relative authority when he's gotten anywhere close.
And he improved massively this year.
Yeah.
He looked like a baby deer that had just been birthed and was covered in viscera
last year.
You know, I just, the way they move,
you know,
not the viscera, like, he wasn't literally covered in viscera. I'm just setting the scene,
you know, painting a picture.
Yes.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean,
if he can, like, continue on that path, you know, like the quantum leap he had this year, he doesn't need a quantum leap next year. He just needs to get another increment better, and then you're looking at a really, really
good contract. Yeah, and I would expect an incremental improvement, especially considering he's still developing physically. We saw a huge difference from last year to this year, and there is still room on his frame.
Yeah, if he can just get, like, another inch or two of lift.
Yeah,
then
and they don't need him to be like Bruno Fernando jacked, but if he can, he can get a little bit stronger in his
I remember Jeff Withey from the year that we played Kansas.
Yes.
And I went back and I was looking at his stats before the game, and you know, he was a pretty good player for his first 3 years at Kansas, and then his senior year, he went from a pretty good player to the best defensive center in the country.
Yeah.
And, like, about the same size. Withey was maybe a little lankier. You know, I'm not saying he's going to be the best defensive center in the country, but I think he's showing that he's pretty good right now.
Yeah.
And I think he's got upside left to explore. So,
I very much agree.
All right. We should probably take a break. We're going to come back and talk about something else.
Let me just tell you a couple things to keep in your mind while you're out there. When we take the field, we're going to win. We've got big goals. We've got big ideas. We've got to win this game, and there is no game on the remainder of our schedule more important than the one you're going down to the tunnel to play today. Now let's go. It's over.
Underground Printing is proud to present the Bow Store. Visit us at our new location at 333 South Main or online at www.bow.team.
It's painless, it's online. It's group ordering made easy for your next custom printed apparel order. Pogo from Underground Printing takes the aggravation out of custom printing for a group. Whether you're selling shirts for a fundraiser, organizing a large event, or trying to collect sizes and payment for a family reunion, Underground Printing is here to help. Save time and hassle every step of the way with our easy-to-use site. No more guessing what to order, chasing people down to pay, or wasting time trying to sort out who needs what. We'll set it up and you can just sit back and relax. We can even take care of individual shipping. To learn more about Pogo, visit us at any of our convenient locations or at pogo.undergroundshirts.com.
I grew up in a small town of Hazlitt, Michigan, and I witnessed a lot of great people making a lot of poor financial decisions. And I thought to myself, I don't want to be in that position. I don't want to have my retirement at risk. Over the last 17 years, my team has developed and refined our process, which helps people understand what's important to them and what they value most. And because people don't have pensions anymore, we're adding in multiple income streams during retirement. At Peak Wealth Management, our goal is to build long-lasting relationships. And we do that by building trust, by showing our integrity, and letting them know how much we care. And that's one of the most important things we do here at Peak, is understand your goals and help you get there.
Hi, this is Matt Demarest from Homeshare Lending. By now, you've probably read about my company on MGO blog, and I wanted to introduce you to a couple of the most important people in my life, my sons Cooper and Colby. Cooper, how old are you?
I'm 7.5.
Colby, how old are you?
I'm 5.
Okay, boys, I have 3 really important questions to ask you. Who's your favorite team?
Michigan.
Who's going to win the big game?
The Wolverines.
And if you could buy or refinance a house with any company, who would you use?
Homeshare Lending.
Good boys. Homeshare Lending, 855-6-BE-SURE. Visit us online if that works better for you. HomeshareLending.com. HomeshareLending.com. We've helped Brian, Seth, and a bunch of readers buy or refinance their homes, and we'd love to help you too. All right, only thing left to do. Boys, can I get a Go Blue?
Go Blue.
Homeshare Lending, NMLS number 1161358. Again, give us a call, 855-6-BE-SURE.
Out of your seat, get up and get down.
All right, it turns out this segment is looking a little bit forward, bracketology, Big Ten tournament kind of stuff. And looking back at the season as a whole, we posted our all Big Ten teams on the site today because we had a lot of problems. It was a Festivus kind of post.
It was.
Because the all Big Ten team doesn't have a freaking center on it. When you have
in a year when bigs are a strength in the conference.
And it has Miles Bridges, who just is the third most valuable guy on his own team.
Yeah. It's a good team.
It's a good team.
It's a real good team.
It's a good team. But anyway, I guess we're going to start with that.
We are starting with it. So let's do it.
So you got to put a center on the all Big Ten team.
Keita Bakes-D up does not count, even though Ohio State occasionally plays him there.
And that center, in my opinion, should be Isaac Haas, also your opinion.
Yes. There are very legit arguments for Ethan Happ. If Alec Cooks was joining us on this podcast, he would be making them.
But he's not.
But he's not. I both go with the team success. A huge part of Purdue's success is that Haas is this monster in the post.
They're the numbers.
And if you help off of him, then they're going to rain fire on you, and he's great at making that work. He doesn't have to be the absolute hero that Ethan Happ is because he has a good team around him and has a solid backup, both of which Happ does not have. Mm-hmm. We've talked about it. Happ plays kind of this, you know, impressive but not super efficient game.
Yes.
Haas is certainly afforded the ability to be efficient by the team around him, but he also manages to do that. Is a behemoth to get around in the post on both ends.
And you mentioned Haas hits free throws.
Yes, I think that's another huge thing that separates these guys is there's kind of a clear way to stop Ethan Happ, and that's to hack him. Mm-hmm. And with Haas, I mean, the clear way to guard Purdue is to hope that Haas doesn't destroy you by shooting like 75% on his post opportunities instead of 65%.
And we're Michigan fans, so we are basing a large part of our opinion on the games that we saw these guys play against Michigan.
That's true.
But I think that's illuminating.
Yeah, I mean, what you've been able to do against the top teams in the conference, especially this year when there is a huge gap between the good teams and the not good teams. Haas was a much bigger factor and much more dangerous against the good teams.
He's a much bigger factor on defense. He scored a lot more efficiently. I mean, Happ didn't have much of an opportunity, but you know, Michigan wasn't doubling. They were daring Happ to beat him, and Happ, you know, got his points, but it took him like.
And on Wisconsin, there are guys that you can double off of.
That's true.
Yeah, like several of them, pretty much all of them.
So even though Happ was the all usage, all king of everything, I think, you know, if I'm drafting centers in the league, I'm taking Haas first. And then we both went with Mo Wagner, although I had a bit of a blip over
Ethan Happ.
Ethan Happ.
Yeah.
Because I mean, we saw him play Ethan Happ, and he won that matchup pretty soundly.
Yeah, I mean, once again, I think when you look beyond just the raw numbers and go for, okay, like what is this person's impact on their entire team? First of all, Wagner makes the five-out thing work.
Yeah.
And that is obviously huge for Michigan's offense. It's a big part of their identity. And then you look at the strides he's made as a rebounder. He is in a similar league with Haas and Happ as a rebounder. Not quite so much on the offensive end, but part of that's coaching. Mm-hmm. But he went from a defensive rebounding liability for the most part to a guy who's pulling in about 35% of them. That's such an enormous leap and something that going back to our discussion of how Michigan's defense has improved, that's a big part of it. So it might be a bit of a homery pick, but I don't have a big problem making it.
I mean, modern basketball guys are kind of similar on the defensive end. Give me the guy who hits threes.
Yeah. And free throws, for that matter.
We had three guys. I thought the four spots at the forward were pretty clear. And the order is maybe the only thing that was up in the air. So, Keita Bates-Jop is
the clear-cut.
Unanimous.
He's the player of the year.
He's a great defensive player as well. Yeah. They were the best defense in conference.
Yeah. And they've been doing a fair amount of that by sometimes sliding him to center. I mean, and he can slide down and guard threes.
Yeah.
He's a versatile switching defender, and that is so valuable.
And then we were kind of torn on whether Juwan Morgan of Indiana or Vincent Edwards of Purdue should be the first team guy.
Yeah, I made the case for Edwards.
And I just thought that, like, for him to be as efficient as he was with absolutely no help from Indiana, and just the fact that he filled up literally every section of the KenPom box score with a top 500 mark except for fouls against him and assists, I thought that was,
That's really impressive. I think Vince Edwards, if my thing is basically, if you take Vince Edwards and put him in the Juwan Morgan situation, I think he puts up very similar numbers.
Okay.
And then when you look at how efficient he was for a very good team this year, he just plays a really tough to defend game.
But we're splitting hairs, really.
We are. I mean, both those guys are very good players. They would both probably be first teamers in a lot of years.
Yeah.
I mean, Bates Diop had a great year at the four. It's impressive that we're mentioning both of those guys over Jaren Jackson,
who's the fourth guy and somehow is the most underrated player in the league.
Yeah, apparently.
I mean, he's shooting like, what, 61-42?
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing that people are worried about is that he does get into foul trouble, but Izzo also sits him more than he needs to.
And he has a 15% block rate as a power forward.
Yeah, he's unbelievable.
Get a center on the floor, and you get a 15% block rate from a four. He probably should be the first team. Like, when you watch Michigan State, who were you afraid of?
It's Jaren Jackson.
Jaren Jackson.
It's the guy who terrifies you at all times. But we had a different Spartan on our first team.
Well, we did. But I was just, I mean,
I know, like, I know we're going through in
order. We put up the post, and like, as the post was up, I was just like, man, Jaren Jackson probably should be on the first team.
There are a couple things that since the post I've
the only I've thing thought. That you can possibly say about him is that he doesn't have great usage. He has like 20% usage, so he's not a go-to guy.
Yeah.
So his offensive efficiency is only peripheral, but
when you measure his defensive impact,
15% block rate.
Yeah, and you look at Michigan State's team defensive stats and you compare them to last year. What's the difference?
Yeah,
it's you put Jaren Jackson in there, and all of a sudden you become one of the best defensive teams in the country.
Yep. Guard spots. I thought the first team was pretty clear. Carson Edwards of Purdue, who is a 30% shot guy. Only 27% of his shots inside the arc are assisted, and he's still efficient.
Yeah.
He's a lethal outside shooter. He's an unassisted three shooter. I mean, you saw him against Michigan. I don't have to explain it to you.
Yeah. The guy's really dang good. He went from kind of a bad shot factory as a freshman to a guy who just started baking all of those shots. Yeah. And while also learning how to play some more efficient ball. He's also a good defender. I mean, the guy I wish was on the NBA radar more. It'd be nice for him to go.
A little short, but as like there's this kind of new generation of Steph-alikes in college basketball.
Yeah, the off-the-bounce shooters.
And he was the best in the league this year.
Yeah.
The other guard was Cassius Winston because he hits 57% from three. That's pretty much all I have to say.
With a top five in the country assist rate.
Yes, and he turns the ball over too much, and he's a turnstile on defense, and it just doesn't matter.
Yeah, his weakness definitely gets covered up in large part by Jaren Jackson and whatnot.
Well, I mean, and Michigan was one of the few teams that was really able to get after it because of their five-out approach. They could actually take the
big men out of the paint. But I do think we mentioned Anthony Cowan. I think he was our second team.
He was second team, yeah.
For being a kind of have to carry the offense, high usage guy.
Mm-hmm.
In retrospect, I think we overlooked Tony Carr here a little bit.
Tony Carr was our second team guy.
I still think he should get more first team consideration. I know he didn't finish well inside the arc, but that guy had to carry for them.
That's true. My thing is he didn't finish well inside the arc, and while he was a good 3-point shooter, he didn't actually take that many.
Yeah, that's true.
So,
but he was also
I know he has
His distribution to a team where when you look around, it's like you're passing to these guys and getting assists. Like
Penn State needs to always has like a second team all Big Ten guard. That's just and nothing else.
Yeah,
that's been the case for like
Tim
10
Frazier.
Years.
You know, they
Taylor Battle.
They've had some guys like that, and Carr is certainly in that vein.
I mean, I see what
Tim
you're
Frazier
saying.
Was a heck of a player. Though.
But if you're telling me that I'm going to take him or Carson Edwards, I'm taking Carson Edwards.
Oh, I mean Carson Edwards, no question.
You think
without
a doubt
is the first team guy
over Winston?
Possibly. I mean, I think he's a much better defender.
Yeah, he is. I still don't care.
Like, yeah, I mean, you know, it's tough when you're doing these because it's like, okay, I'd rather have Tony Carr on Penn State than Cassius Winston.
Yeah.
On Michigan State, I'd probably rather have Cassius Winston than Tony Carr.
Yeah.
Because he's going to hit a bunch of open threes.
Yeah. Well, there you go.
Yeah. So it's a weird list.
We don't need to go through the other ones. It's on the site. Just read the site if you want.
I mean, Z got robbed.
Z did get robbed for an all defense pick.
And, you know, we saw him match up with Cowan. Z won that battle.
We saw him match up with Winston, and he got destroyed.
Yeah. So I think
Winston, that is.
I think Simpson did get overlooked there.
Like the only guy to have a good game against Xavier Simpson in the Big Ten season was like Bryant McIntosh somehow.
By hitting a bunch of improbable floaters, which like sometimes that's gonna happen.
And Mason did too, but that's because he was taking a bunch of 17-footers off the dribble, which nobody should be trying to defend.
Yeah. So when guys aren't just making bad ideas,
that Minnesota game was so annoying.
Well, they still won, though.
So. Well, yeah, but I wrote the preview, and I'm like, these guys can't shoot mid-range jump shots for crap. And then I'm just like, Isaiah Washington is pulling up from 15 feet.
The like Isaiah Washington goes unconscious aspect of that game was bizarre.
Anyway, as far as the future goes, Michigan's still on the six line. They're a strong six now.
Yeah, they're the top six on the bracket matrix right now. And that's with like a couple weird, like someone's got them as an eight in there that's weighing them down. I mean, and that was a recently updated one. And what the hell?
There's going to be outliers for all those teams. But I think if they go 1-1 at the Big Ten tournament, they should probably stick as a six.
Like, yes, I would agree with that.
Don't put up a bad loss and nobody's going to like squint too hard if you lose against Nebraska.
Yeah.
I wonder if 2-1 might get them to a five. Like, have they beaten Nebraska?
I think it will both. I mean, they're likely playing Michigan State.
2-1 is lose to
lose to Michigan State. I think that does still get them there as long as they don't get blasted. I mean, just based on playing around with Torvik's site and the projections there a little bit.
Yeah.
The last time I did that simulation, that got them to a five seed.
Okay.
I mean, I think the good news here is that, you know, barring a loss in the first game, which seems unlikely, and even then might not be enough to knock Michigan completely off the sixth line.
Yeah.
I think there's really only upward mobility here in the tournament for the most part, because they could, you know, if they go through and win the thing where they you know, if they get through Michigan State and either Purdue or Ohio State.
Committee might pay attention this year.
Yeah.
Because it's a week early.
Yeah, that they'll have actually watched it instead of filling out their brackets and, you know, keeping an eye on it. That's something that, I mean, at least when I did the simulation on Torvik's tourney cast, that got him up to a three seed.
That's not.
I don't think they'll get up, but like a four seed would be great. Especially if they, you know, that if they get that protected seed and that maybe gets them the four seed in Detroit, that'd be real
nice. Would they do that?
I think they'd need a little bit of help.
Michigan State is one of the items in Detroit.
Yes. They are a protected seed that would get priority.
Like Purdue. I mean, Michigan's hoping that the committee doesn't just go by straight distance because Purdue is like 40 feet closer to Detroit than it is Nashville.
Yeah.
And then they would try to get Michigan in for attendance.
Yes. So we'll see. I mean, there is a chance that they go on a run that they could not only get a better seed than we expected, but a nice location as well.
But that probably takes like winning the whole thing.
That might require just, you know, doing the whole damn thing, but they did it last year.
Under I know what you're thinking,
ridiculous circumstances.
Listeners, don't hope for a plane crash, you jerks.
You said the thing that
jerks.
We didn't need to say, man. We didn't need it.
Don't hope for that. I know what you're thinking. I wasn't thinking that. You were.
I only live like 5 minutes away from Willow Run Airport. I'm happy to go out there and make sure that there aren't any suspicious people lingering around the team plane.
Okay, that's
I wasn't about to go sabotage mode. No, I'm preventing this.
Like, this is
vigilante, not sabotage. No. No.
And do we have any thoughts about who we want to see in the tournament, the actual tournament? I have a thought.
Is Cincinnati your thought?
I was thinking West Virginia. Michigan gets a 5 next to West Virginia, one of those teams that's like super foul all the time, like make a ton of turnovers, get a bunch of offensive boards. That's a terrible matchup. That's a VCU matchup.
Yeah, no, I like that. Cincinnati stands out to me in terms of they are really, really heavily reliant on offensive rebounds for their offense. And their defense, I mentioned them in the transition team. They are one of those really good transition defenses. They are another team that relies heavily on turnover creation.
So that's, Michigan that's doesn't another. Turn the ball over, and if your offense is dependent on transition, we're a terrible matchup.
Yes.
So Xavier is actually, I think, ranked below Michigan on KenPom now.
They're up to 13. It's been close.
Every time I look, it's like, oh, Tennessee passed us. Oh, Ohio State passed us. Oh, we passed Tennessee.
Yeah, those three teams had a ridiculously close, non-existent margin between them for the past week.
But so this is a situation where you could go into a game against a one seed and think that you were 50-50 or close to win, which would be nice.
Yeah, I mean, Xavier's only got the number 71 defense in the country.
Michigan's made that work before, but not as a one seed.
No. Especially since Xavier's also pretty – they're a really good shooting team, and Michigan's been so darn good at just not letting you get good three-point hooks that I like them going against.
Who jumps out as like a please no? I don't want to see North Carolina in our region.
I don't want to see North Carolina again. I don't want to see Villanova. Jay Wright's a hell of a coach, and that team is really experienced, and they've got really good talent. Villanova worries me a little bit.
Anybody other than Syracuse, a heavy zone team? I don't want to see zone. I hate zone against Michigan. Not really. I think maybe someone has it, but they're not like a.
Yeah, I don't think there's like a primarily zone team. Yeah. Michigan's more likely to run into Virginia's death ball.
Yeah, Virginia is another one that
I'm torn on that one. Because they never do well, seemingly. But that's one of those things where you go like small. Every great college basketball coach had that period of the dude's never made it past the second round, and then he wins a title. And it's like, oh, okay, it's a very small sample we're working off of.
I do feel like Virginia is more likely to get bounced by a team that can overwhelm them athletically, and Michigan's not that team.
Yeah. In Virginia also, I just get uncomfortable playing with a team that intentionally drags the tempo down so low that you start to get small sample size theater within a single game.
Well, I mean, that Michigan will be totally comfortable with that.
Michigan is not like their normal fire-breathing shooting team that they were before. I mean, we've seen lineup changes lately that maybe could change that for the tournament, but I would have been more comfortable with some past Michigan teams playing a one seed Virginia.
Yeah. I haven't looked up any individual player matchups, but a team like Oregon last year, I would not want to see again.
No, the athleticism on the perimeter would
worry
me.
Yeah, just having a four who can just get to the bucket at will is not really ideal.
Yeah, I mean, the good news is one of the teams that I'd probably say, I mean, despite how the first matchup went, that I wouldn't necessarily want to see Michigan rematch with in the tournament is Michigan State. That's a type of team I'd like to avoid because they can shoot the lights out and they're big and athletic.
Yeah, I mean, I was kind of not considering
that. But since they're in our conference, the committee's going to make sure that matchup doesn't happen until late, if it happens at all.
Well, there's only going to be four Big Ten teams in the tournament, so I bet they're in different regions.
Yeah, four different regions, probably, yeah.
So,
It'll be easy to keep the cream of the Big Ten crop away from each other. Because there ain't much of it. It's not 2013.
No, sir. All right, we're going to take a break. We're going to come back, and we are going to talk about the FBI and also Tim Drefno.
We have a lot in common. You rode the bus to Bursley, so did Larry Page, and so did I. And we all love MGO Blog. I'm Nick Hopwood, your MGO financial coach. My entire family went to Michigan State, but I was the smart one finding my way to Ann Arbor to study econ. I've been a financial planner for 17 years, earning the designation Certified Financial Planner, and founded Peak Wealth Management in Plymouth. know you're pretty smart, and you probably have a sweet retirement spreadsheet already. My job is to make sure. As a financial coach, I make sure you're on track, or if you're not on track, I tell you exactly what you're going to need to do. And if you listen, I'll be able to tell you how your future should look, just like the knowledge. And I have cool charts and graphs to tell the story, sort of like the Mathlete. To learn more or schedule time to chat, check out peakwm.com/mgoblog.
If you need a place to stay in Ann Arbor and don't want to be stuck out by I-94, there's a new hotel downtown, and the owners, who should be well known to the Michigan community, have asked our help to get the word out. The Martin family, yes, that Martin family, recently opened the Residence Inn Ann Arbor downtown, just a block from Main Street and a short walk to Michigan Stadium. They're competitively priced and offer a free hot breakfast, free Wi-Fi, fully equipped kitchen and every suite and an indoor pool. That's the Residence Inn Ann Arbor downtown.
In southeastern Michigan, the yearly cost for a nursing home averages $90,000. It doesn't have to, though. Reed McCarthy founded Ann Arbor Elder Law after handling a tricky situation for his own family. Years of experience later, his boutique firm works with clients across southeast Michigan dealing with Medicaid planning, long-term care, and tax, disability, and family law, not to mention family dynamics. If you have a family member who may need that level of care, or if you're ready to start your own estate plan, Reed can give you a plan for the future. Visit AnnArborElderLaw.com or call 734-945-9693. That's 734-945-9693.
Want the perfect game day outfit? Underground Printing has unique, great-fitting UM apparel and officially licensed apparel from legendary Michigan names like Woodson, Howard, Schembechler, Ufer, and more. UGP also specializes in custom printed apparel and promotional items for groups, events, and businesses. Whether you need one shirt as a gift or 1,000 shirts for a charity walk, Underground can customize almost anything for groups large or small. To learn more, visit Underground Printing at one of our three convenient locations around Ann Arbor or online at undergroundshirts.com.
The places you'll go may seem far from Ann Arbor. From San Francisco to St. Louis to Shanghai. But as members of the Alumni Association, we're never far. Because Michigan is more than a place. It's a mindset that connects us. For those who leave Michigan, but for whom Michigan never leaves, this is where you belong. The Alumni Association of the University of Michigan. Join today at umalumni.com.
Every part, but I knew love would be complicated.
I guess we'll start with DrevNow because that is more directly relevant.
Fair
to
enough.
Our audience.
Yes, yeah, that's true.
He got axed.
He did.
And the way he got axed kind of looked like Michigan was trying to find him a landing spot to save him the
indignity
of being axed, and nobody wanted him.
Yeah, I mean which
is sad, but also kind of points to like it's probably a good thing he got axed.
Yes. And also, when you look back on it, like the hiring Ed Wardner to be an analyst, I bet they had some conversations with him that were like, there's a good chance this isn't just an analyst position.
Yeah, like, do you want to take a demotion to be an off-field coach at Michigan? Like, well, I could probably pay as much.
Guy who was, Minnesota. Like, widely considered the best offensive line coach in the country for a significant period of time.
Yeah.
And really, the only reason that didn't continue is because Ohio State added play calling responsibilities that he was not good at.
Yeah, he got Peter principled, and then yeah. Ohio State fans, they had this, even at the end, they kind of had a love-hate relationship with him.
But, because they knew that their offensive line was still yeah. very good in large part because of him. But
so this retroactively makes the McElwain hire more tolerable, but still not that happy with it.
Yeah.
Doesn't really matter because, of course, this is Jim Harbaugh's offense.
Yeah.
And there's no quarterback coach waiting in the wing, so Pep Hamilton might be safe. But some of the things that I was very frustrated about, you know, a couple months ago, I was kind of openly wondering when Tim DeRevno would actually feel the heat. In retrospect,
that was happening.
That was happening.
Yeah.
So that does make my optimism about the upcoming season greater. I mean,
yeah,
I know Drefno was an old hand under Harbaugh. I know his track record looked pretty good, but you know, when you miss on so many guys and then you make some pretty big talent mistakes, it's
well, and especially also when you have the chance to put Ed Warner in his place. I mean, that's a guy whose track record is really tough to doubt.
James Light posted something on Twitter, which is he's just Ed Warner doing clinic stuff, and he's talking about inside zone, and he's like, hold your double until you can feel the linebacker's breath. Never leave that double. And I was like, thank you. Thank God, because I cannot tell you how many times I've seen people leave an inside zone double 1,000 years too early. I hate it. So if that's all he does is get Michigan to run the kind of pounding inside zone that Ohio State does and let the linebackers try to hit those gaps, then God bless them.
Yeah. So I am pretty excited about what Warner can do with the offensive line.
And
he's going to have to do some work.
And the thing is like, so we bring in Greg Fry, and it doesn't work, and it's the Michigan changes midseason. They're like, we're not going to do this. So even though Warner cut his teeth at Ohio State, which is now a spread outfit, not the same kind of spread outfit that Rich Rod is.
No, power spread.
So they run a bunch of power. They run a bunch of tight zone. You know, it's all about moving people off the line of scrimmage. A much closer fit for what Michigan wants to do under Harbaugh than Fry.
Yeah, I mean, like you go back and look at, you know, like the last Ohio State national championship when they blasted Alabama. That was all power and counter, and they destroyed Alabama with that.
Right. So won't be that much of an adjustment, even though the quarterback is taking the snap from under center. And thumbs up to that move. Recruiting got off the mat. Got a four-star offensive line recruit.
They did get a person. Yes.
Might have been told what was coming down the pipe. I don't know. So, you know, hopefully this can be the start of a renaissance on the offensive line. I just can't get over the fact that they couldn't pick up a freaking stun all year. Like, how does that happen? I don't know. Anyway, on to cheerier subjects.
The FBI.
First thing I want to say is, you know, the FBI could be doing a lot worse stuff. You know, that's not an organization that has a pristine track record with what it wants to focus on.
No, I'll refrain from commenting as much as I'd like to on this, but I think, fully agree with you on that.
I think we can mention the fact that they were writing letters to Martin Luther King.
Yes, that is the first thing.
Trying
that comes
to get
to
him to kill himself.
Yes, so let's start there. It's like, you know, this is a better thing than that.
Could be worse.
Yeah. So let's, you know,
the second
let's maybe
thing
not
is,
complain about what they're focusing on as much.
Second thing is, I think this is a completely valid thing for the FBI to focus on because it's a widespread, I don't know if it's criminal or not, but it's a widespread kind of corruption that the NCAA has these rules and they're being constantly flouted in ways that I think are probably, at least at the margins, illegal. I don't think people are reporting these gifts on their taxes.
I doubt there's all of this is reported income.
And I do think that there's a correlation between this kind of, okay, these rules we're not going to play by, and the kind of stuff that you see at UNC. And the kind of stuff that you see at Baylor.
Sure.
And the kind of stuff that you see at Michigan State, where there's a culture that you're like, these rules don't count, so we don't have to follow these rules, and we're going to be fine. And then people are like, oh, well, maybe I'll go get some prostitutes.
Yeah, I mean, I think that depends on the program in terms of how you set the culture.
I
don't disagree that there you can have programs that get this full-blown Wild West feel to them where there are no rules. And I think the other point here where I'm glad that the FBI is bringing this stuff to light is that these payments are what allow the NCAA to hold on to this bullshit amateurism model without like a full-scale player revolt.
Yeah.
Because DeAndre Ayton should be making millions of dollars probably this year.
At least
Yeah, you know. Yeah, like, you know, if you looked at what an NBA team would give him just for the rights to have him in the future, they'd pay him quite a bit this year just to have rights to him when he decided to go pro, if he decided to go that route.
Well, I mean, there's...
But he's certainly worth more than $100,000.
Exactly.
And that was the shockingly huge number that was thrown out there that people were appalled by. It was right. Like, you know, he and Brian Bowen getting 100K. You know, like Markelle Fultz was the number one pick in the NBA draft, and he only got 10 grand.
God, 10 grand. It could have been it. That's just part of it.
I mean, yeah. I mean, just that was on this one spreadsheet. So, I mean, and that's the other thing. This is just the tip of the iceberg. There are 9 or 10 other agencies that all operate. And there's no reason for agencies not to operate like this for the most part because...
The NCAA has no leverage over them.
Yeah, because those rules don't apply to them.
So, like...
Like, it's not illegal for that agent to give a gift to a college kid.
Right.
I mean, it's illegal for the college kid not to report the income, but the gift from the guy is totally above board.
Well, one of the extraordinarily dumb things about the NCAA banning agents from signing players is that, okay, you've taken everything away from us. What can you do to us if we disobey your rules? Nothing. So I feel pretty certain that we've already seen this in hockey, where you can sign with an agent.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're going to see it NCAA-wide.
The NBA is also moving towards getting rid of the one-and-done rule, which is going to help solve a fair amount of this, too.
Really?
Yes. I mean, I think popular opinion has really gotten behind that, like, you're limiting a labor market that you shouldn't be able to limit there. And, you know, football, people are less going after that just because of the physical development required to get there. I still think there should be ways where you can get rights to guys or something earlier.
Sure.
But for NBA, like, you can have 18-year-olds who can contribute in a rotation in the NBA.
Yeah.
They're rare, but
one of them was named LeBron James.
Yeah, but they exist. Like, how criminal would it have been for LeBron to have to play a year of college ball?
Probably at Ohio State.
Right? Yeah, nobody would have wanted to see that except everybody in Columbus. And why would they be happy? We don't want that. So
agents are, I think you're going to see that open up. I think you're also going to see... I hope you're going to see the NCAA just kind of take that NHL draft model and be like, fine, you know, we're going to draft and follow.
Yeah.
And part of that is what the NBA does. So the NBA makes you opt in, and the NHL is just like, everybody who plays hockey who's 18 years old is in the draft.
Yeah.
So and that's actually a change the NBA could make. And then if the NCAA was just like, you know what, you can sign with a professional team, and they can pay you, and as long as you're in school – as long as you're keeping up with the coursework that we expect you to do, you're still eligible.
Yeah. And if you're not, then there's the NBA Developmental League. So,
right.
I mean, there is a viable alternative, but you want those players to be able to get paid because right now nobody's looking at going straight to the D League the G League these days.
Let's call it the Trey League.
It's not Trey's League anymore. Oh. He's blowing up on the Knicks.
He is. But
that's not the option anybody's looking at straight out of high school.
Well,
and like for people to go like, oh, well, you can go play overseas. Like that's a pretty crappy way to justify not paying these guys.
Well, and there's kind of like two paths. One is that the NCAA actually lets it go and like, all right, we're going to pay players ourselves.
Yes.
And there are some potential downsides to that where...
It does get tricky.
Hypothetically, Title IX gets involved. Hypothetically...
Yes.
You start focusing so heavily on paying the football players that, you know, the gymnasts get tetanus from their equipment, you know, like...
There are concerns. I don't think... People bring them up as reasons to not even discuss it,
right.
Which is not constructive.
I think that there are some arguments that at least have to be dealt with.
Yes. But it still could be a viable option. Yeah. I don't think it's totally
And then there's the NCAA just getting rid of their compliance departments.
Just go Olympic model.
And going Olympic model and changing their draft model to allow people to get paid and still play NCAA basketball, there can be no possible argument about whether this makes sense, whether it's just, whether it's moral, and whether it's more equitable for the sport. Because you cannot enforce this unless the FBI once every 50 years is like, we're interested in this now because we don't have anyone we need to kill. Not kill. Convince to kill themselves.
Try to persuade.
Anyway.
I like the Olympic model. I like that it, you know, because you'd get, you know, like Duncan Robinson doing a Ford dealership advertisement or something like that, where it stays kind of, and then like bigger players would get, you know, like Nike deals or whatever.
Yeah.
But you'd have like, you could get some of that fun, like, you know, local flavor to the, like, you know.
That's actually the only argument I've heard that makes me not want to do it.
You don't want to see like, this is no, Jordan Poole for Mr. No, Spots. Come on, dude. Come on.
I don't. But like, so I've posted this on the site before, but what I think the NBA should do is they should expand their draft to 5 rounds, and they should have it after your first year of high school. Everybody's in. So like Jordan Poole is a 4th round draft pick of Milwaukee or whatever.
Yeah.
He can still play. He can sign and he can get paid that way. I mean, my original proposal is like, you don't sign, but I think that you should be able to, but this was a little bit less radical. If an NBA team signs you, they have to sign you to a contract that is 1 year longer than your college career. So if you sign them out of high school, it's a 5-year deal.
Yeah.
Sign them after your freshman year, it's a 4-year deal. If you sign them after your senior year, I mean, that's up to you. You can do whatever you want.
Yeah. So, and the NBA does have rookie wage scale stuff in there that would probably factor in here.
Right. And what I would like to see is the rookie wage scale be based not on seniority, but just age.
Yeah.
So that like there's like in college hockey right now, there's, you know, this real push to get everyone to leave college because you have an entry level contract that's 3 years long and is capped.
Yeah. And you want to start that clock. Right.
Yeah, exactly. So you don't want to make seniority about, you don't want to make getting paid about seniority. You want to make NBA programs make kind of a decision like, and you have to carry that guy in the active roster. Like, even if he's in the G League, he counts as a member of your roster. So it's like, well, do we want this guy on the team or do we want to let him?
Yeah, because the NBA now has introduced two-way deals as well. Yeah. So that becomes a thing that.
And then, like, Summer League college guys can just play in Summer League and then just
go for it. Yeah, and you factor in the Developmental League too, where, you know, maybe guys go college, G League, NBA, if, you know. If they're the type where they want to not be students and go get full-time basketball instruction earlier, the NBA is starting to put more resources into the G League, where that's becoming more of a place where you can actually go and develop instead of just like, oh, we screwed up this draft pick, so you're going to go play here now.
But I think that kind of draft and follow method is a win for everybody. I think it's a win for the NBA because you have the same kind of setup where these guys are college stars and they're getting promotion before you're actually
picked. You're going to get resistance from the NBA management side of things because they're not going to like the uncertainty and having to draft these, having to do more projection to draft these guys and get the rights early. I would say tough, whatever. Tough cookies. This is a family podcast.
It's good. It's good for the, it's not really, you just bullshit
no.
earlier.
That's it.
But it's not it's a win for college because you get these guys for as long as they should be in college, and you're getting a lot more NBA fan eyes. Like, if, you know, Poole's a 4th round draft pick,
I think that is a great point and would be a great thing for college basketball. Is there is considerable NBA interest already in the draft, where you have these guys who, I mean, it's a cottage industry just like the NFL draft is. Mm-hmm. So you have these guys following prospects for years, and if NBA fans specifically were like, oh, like, this is one of my team's guys. Yeah. Like, you'd have, you know, kind of ancillary fans of college basketball programs for potentially years with some of these guys.
So it's, and it doesn't hurt anybody, because if any money goes to these guys, it's money from agents, it's money from the NBA. Even that kind of like, well, what if a booster gives him $1 million and then he thinks that he owes this guy to play basketball, which is the most insane thing that I hear on a regular basis, because one, it's already happening, and two, what are the downsides? Rich man gives poor man money.
Yeah, like I'm generally in favor of that in pretty much all forms. Yeah, I mean, you know, when you take out the NCAA language, it is just, you know, like, wealthy businessman gives player money for his talents. Like, yeah. That's how the free market generally tends to work.
Yeah.
I've never been on board with the whole, like, sports are an exception to the entire rest of the employment marketplace.
To the economy.
Yeah.
That's the other thing, is like, well, how do you determine who gets paid what? And I'm like, we have a system for that.
we really have set this up. We can debate the merits of that in a completely different forum, but we do have a system for this.
It's been thought of by Adam Smith. I don't know if you remember his name.
Yeah, like we have some precedent here to work with.
Oh, this is the worst.
So the people who are afraid that, like, you know, who bring up that, like, you know, what if, like, the 99th walk-on on the football team gets $200,000 a year while a gymnast gets, you know, like, a $5 lunch stipend? Like, that's not going to happen. It's just not. Well,
and one thing that I think should be pointed out is that females are 57% of undergraduate populations at colleges now.
Mm-hmm.
And college football and college basketball are much blacker than other sports.
Yeah.
So if you're telling me that, you know, a girl on the lacrosse team doesn't have as much access to something while she's getting a full scholarship, while she's getting that, and the result of that is some guy who came from Denard Robinson's neighborhood is getting some more money, I'm all in favor of that.
Yeah.
Like, I respect female athletes at Division I universities, but you can run their sports at a fraction of the cost they are currently getting.
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad that those sports are getting funded more. I think there have been, I mean, we've talked about this for a long time. It's not just with women's sports. The athletic departments are trying any way they can to make it look like they're not making massive profits,
right,
by throwing a ton of money into facilities for these sports where, you know, every college has world-class facilities for these sports, so they're like the major ones at least.
Yeah.
Power conferences, if you don't have like legitimate world-class facilities for non-revenue sports, you're falling behind. And, you know,
well, also, you're just not hiding your revenue very well.
Yeah, that too. I think they should, you know, I want them to support these sports. I want them to continue having these sports at Michigan. I think it's great. Do they need to have the absolute best in everything in facilities for every sport when the way they're financing that is by taking money from players, essentially, in the revenue sports? I don't think that's necessary.
Yeah.
And I think that cuts into the Title IX argument by just going, you can keep these sports, we just don't have to fund them so lavishly. Because it really is lavish the way they're doing it right now.
And the football,
like, if you walk around Michigan's athletic campus, it's nuts.
Yeah, football's equally lavish, but the difference there is that they are the ones that
have generated that money.
Yeah. And also,
and that's still a way that they're, you know, they're giving all these players perks, but those perks could just be money in their pocket.
And also, football in particular, they are putting their bodies on the line.
Yes.
For that money.
And I think there's still stuff, you know, like you look at the injury rates for female gymnasts and it's concerning. And, you know, there's stuff to talk about in terms of health coverage and how that should be handled.
Sure. Yeah.
And I think, again, that's why you want to start looking at get rid of the freaking student athlete term and start talking about
these
people as employees.
Anymore.
Yeah. It's a lie. They're athletes who attend college.
And let them major in their sport, for God's sake.
it's a career. So, yeah, I mean, if the whole point of college is that you're getting people ready for their profession, what are we doing here?
Well, I mean, my wife teaches, and she gets a lot of athletes, and, like, she had a swimmer once. It was a freshman swimmer, and the guy was just completely overwhelmed by having to go to practice and having to go to meets and still having to catch up on all his homework, and it's like a 40-hour thing, even for a swimmer, and that's a non-revenue job. Non-revenue job. The NCAA, everybody. And it was just...
it's a full-time job that, like, you don't get paid for.
He kind of had a breakdown at her, and I was like, well... Yeah.
I'd break down too if I had that kind of workload in college. That's a lot.
Yeah.
These guys handle a lot.
I played a lot of Jedi Knight in college.
I was running a lot of Halo. NHL 07 and Halo 3.
Yeah. But go FBI. And if I think that this might be the tipping point where we see not necessarily the NCAA directly paying their players, but opening it up at least to certified agents, and hopefully the Olympic model takes over. And if that's the result of an FBI investigation that I think is a legitimate investigation into potential crimes, then that's a really good outcome. And
yeah.
I think that would be a good use of someone's time.
Yeah, no, if this ends up fundamentally changing the way a multi-billion-dollar industry works, I'd say that's worthwhile.
Yeah, it's worth your time. All right, we're going to take one more break, come back, and talk some hockey.
If you find yourself on the wrong side of the law in Ann Arbor or around Metro Detroit, you want a Michigan man in the huddle. Call former prosecutor and now criminal defense attorney Jonathan Paul at 248-924-9458 or visit his website, michiganlawgrad.com.
No man is more important than the team. No coach is more important than the team. The team, the team, the team. You and I know it's going to be Michigan again. Michigan.
Underground Printing and most sports shops are proud to present a new retail experience, the Bo Store. Exclusively licensed Bo Schembechler brand merchandise. Throws downfield to Carter. Carter ends up.
If you need a place to stay in Ann Arbor and don't want to be stuck out by I-94, there's a new hotel downtown, and the owners, who should be well known to the Michigan community, have asked our help to get the word out. The Martin family, yes, that Martin family, recently opened the Residence Inn Ann Arbor downtown, just a block from Main Street and a short walk to Michigan Stadium. They're competitively priced and offer a free hot breakfast, free Wi-Fi, fully equipped kitchen and every suite, and an indoor pool. That's the Residence Inn Ann Arbor downtown.
The places you'll go may seem far from Ann Arbor. From San Francisco to St. Louis to Shanghai. But as members of the Alumni Association, we're never far. Because Michigan is more than a place. It's a mindset that connects us. For those who leave Michigan, but for whom Michigan never leaves, this is where you belong. The Alumni Association of the University of Michigan. Join today at umalumni.com.
Hey, Brian, I want you to know something. Icicles are pretty.
They're pretty wasteful. If you have icicles, chances are you have cold rooms. Here's what you need to do. You need to call Ecotelligent Homes for a comprehensive home energy audit. They will find the source of the issue. Their licensed teams will install the fixes. They will help you qualify for the right local rebates, and they even offer financing. Ecotelligent Homes is an award-winning DTE Energy and Consumers Trade ally. Call 248-291-7815. Or visit their website at ecotelligenthomes.com. Hockey podcast is now. Ace is actually on this one. Hi.
Yeah,
Ace.
Still kept the headset. Boot me out.
So's Dave.
Hello.
How you doing, Dave?
I'm doing well. How are you, Brian?
Well, I'm good. I'm a little bit nervous about the penalty kill.
Yeah, I was about to say, how are your special teams doing?
Oh, so bad. So bad. So Anthony and I were talking, and well, you were here for part of that.
Yeah.
So Michigan's Michigan sweeps Arizona State and now is in position where I think any series win against Wisconsin puts them in the tournament.
Probably.
And even if they go 1-2 against Wisconsin, I think they are still in the tournament. Getting swept is danger zone time.
Yeah.
Without anybody else playing, the worst that happened without Michigan getting swept was them in the 12th spot. And they would take a number of teams moving past Michigan either with an auto bid or actually moving past Michigan could happen, but there's a reason that the pairwise projector at College Hockey News has Michigan at 96% in.
All right.
So probably safe. One win this weekend, I think, does it. Of course, Michigan would like to do more than that and maybe stay off the four line if possible.
Yeah, and they're in a position where winning a couple games against a team that's, 23rd in pairwise,
yeah,
could put them in conversation for a three seed?
Well, I mean, they're a three now, and they're going to be a two or a three if the season ends fairly well.
Right.
So their absolute ceiling is like the number seven seed.
Yeah, I think so too. I think that Ohio State, yeah, I don't think they can pass Ohio State.
No. But it doesn't really matter what happens once they get in the tournament, because there are no regionals within, I think, literally 1,000 miles.
Okay, ready for this? I was almost going to tweet this at you today because I looked it up this morning, and we saw that, what, it's Sioux Falls is in the West and Allentown is in the Midwest, right?
Yeah.
So I was like, oh, I wonder what it's going to be next year. Do you want to guess where the West regional?
I know, because I looked it up.
Did you do it too?
It's Fargo
and Allentown. So it's almost identical to what the sites are for this year.
And there are like 14 college hockey teams in Michigan, Indiana, Ohio, and Pittsburgh. It's like a quarter of college hockey.
The purpose is to like move it around. Even if you're trying to grow the sport, the purpose is to move it around.
They'll often give one venue 2 years in a row. Like that happened at Yost back in the day.
Oh, okay. But
Allentown, Pennsylvania? Yeah, I don't think so.
And then, I mean, Sioux Falls and Fargo are, yeah, I get they're not the same place, but they're the same place.
There was a guy who replied to me when I said that South Dakota was a hotbed of college hockey. So if he's listening to this podcast, you've upset him a great deal.
Is somebody put in a wood chipper here? Like, do we have to worry about that?
Well, no, that's, oh, Fargo.
Yeah.
No, he's from South Dakota. So he's okay. From Sioux
I've
Falls.
Actually spent a decent amount of time in South Dakota. My dad lived across the river, so I played a lot of golf there. It's pretty nice. So
anyway, the penalty kill is atrocious, and we were talking about it. It's largely because Michigan seems content to give up shots inside the blue line directly in front of the net, which is actually a really good spot to shoot from.
Or from anywhere.
You know, I think they have a very passive penalty kill.
Extremely passive.
And it's just not working. I don't know if they can fix it this year because obviously they haven't done much. But this weekend was Michigan running out to 3-4 goal leads. And then their penalty kill got Arizona State back in the game.
Yeah, and you want to venture a guess as to Arizona State's power play percentage?
Not good.
12%.
12%?
They're bottom five, I think, in the league going into last weekend.
So, I mean, this is a team that has been playing very well. They've played themselves into the tournament. They're really gangbusters at 5-on-5. They outplayed the number one team in the country at the time, Notre Dame, 5-on-5, probably 4 straight games.
Yeah.
And it's all going to go to hell if they take a bunch of penalties in the wrong game.
Yeah, and ironically, so Michigan's 1-2-1, I believe, against Wisconsin this year.
Yeah.
And the game that they won, they were 2-for-5 on the power play and killed 6 of 7 penalties.
It's really strange to watch this team like come together and start really improving and you know, various guys are stepping forward. And then the one thing that is like the big problem that should have been like the flashing thing that you really need to address is just the same.
I don't remember Michigan. I mean, I know they've had bad power plays and penalty kills in the past, but I don't ever remember it being like this.
No,
and
I don't
especially
either.
When you see the improvement on defense in general, like I don't get how that doesn't translate over to somewhat on the power play. Like I'm not saying it has to be 100%.
Yeah.
But it's almost like the power play has gotten worse as the defense has gotten better.
The kill, you mean?
Yes, I'm sorry. The penalty kill has gotten worse as the defense overall has gotten better.
It certainly seems like it because you're not looking at – I mean, you're looking at a team that barely gives up an odd man rush these days, and the penalty kill is just death.
Yeah.
But that's the only thing that's really a big problem with this team right now. It's a huge problem, but we should also focus on the fact that, hey, they're in the tournament, probably.
Like we talked about, they got to host this series. Like, win enough games to host this particular series. Semifinals and finals, you know, we'll see what happens. But this is the one you want to host because this is like the slam dunk. Like, if they win this series, they're in. They're playing for a seed and all that. So they have home ice now. And against a team, their only win in February came when they beat Michigan because Hayden Levine kind of had a meltdown game. And other than that...
I forgot about that.
And other than that, though, I mean, they haven't beaten anyone.
No, and that...
Going back to late January.
I remember that, like, they got up, like, 4-0 in that game, didn't they?
Yeah.
And Michigan came storming back, and I was like, they pulled the goalie two goals too late, and the first two were so bad.
Yeah, and then the power play shot from the point was not great either. And, you know, Michigan worked their way back into that game a little bit. Three of the four games that Michigan has played against Wisconsin, I think they've had the puck more. Like, if you look at their Corsi numbers, they've outplayed them relatively significantly. A couple of those games, they were losing by a few goals. So I think that that kind of, you know, Wisconsin shut it down a little bit, kind of like how Michigan did against Notre Dame.
Yeah.
But they still had a lot of opportunities. And we talked about that game where that Levine didn't play well. Like, if they finish any of their chances, they tie the game up. I mean, they had a lot of opportunities in by the net, and Wisconsin's goalie bailed them out. And Michigan couldn't finish, and, you know, they ended up losing a game that they could have gotten back into.
Yeah, and, you know, I think a key component of Michigan's kind of surge here is they're developing some scoring depth. So, you know, I think the Becker and Pastyov line has been quality for at least the second half of the season. Like, if that was a third line or a really good Michigan team, I could deal with that at this point. Like, that seems like a really solid third line. And the second line is kind of like, not really feeling, you know, James Sanchez on a scoring line. But,
well, they tried Warren there a little bit. I think they moved Raby up for a tiny bit. I mean, they're trying different guys on that line.
It's kind of like, that's like a
But that's whole, the Will Lockwood spot, right?
Yeah, and that's because of the Lockwood injury. And otherwise, like, the top line is really performing, and you're seeing Quinn Hughes both leave his teammates in the lurch less often and start asserting himself even more than he has previously this year. So, I mean, even Ace has an opinion about Quinn Hughes.
I like watching him.
I did
watch Notre Dame weekend.
I know.
That's a popular opinion.
Yeah. That's good.
I don't think anyone's going to turn down a shot at Quinn Hughes.
But, like, Hughes kind of had a tendency to, like, skate around and do some really impressive things, but there wasn't a whole lot of payoff. And now I feel like he's creating a lot more chances.
And, like, when you're counting these odd man rushes, it's funny, like, how many times I'm writing down that Hughes is one of the guys in the rush. So, like, he's coming up and, like, leaving a forward behind him as he starts, like, a three-on-two.
One of his favorite things to do is he'll pass it to a guy right at the blue line so that it takes him over the blue line, and then he smacks his stick on the ice because he's ripping through the defense and he wants it back.
Yeah.
He doesn't get it nearly enough for his taste, and possibly mine. But yeah, when he's coming up ice, he turns into a forward, and I think that takes some getting used to. And I think that's Michigan's forwards now have to be hyper aware when he's on the ice and adjust. But that kind of ability to flow from offense to defense was the thing that Jordan Leopold did for Minnesota back in the day when he won the Hobie as a defenseman who scored like 2 points a game.
That's really going back, yeah.
Well, I mean, I remember Michigan playing Minnesota, and I was just like, what is this? Because it looked like something entirely different. It looked like someone had reinvented hockey. And there were no defensemen, and there were no forwards. It was total hockey.
Just four forwards and one defenseman.
And Quinn Hughes is total hockey.
Like, yeah.
He's you want to call him a defenseman, all right, I guess he plays defense, but that's not encompassing his whole game. And if he can just, like, focus and, like, Jack Johnson up as a sophomore and come back as a sophomore.
I'll take another year of him. I mean, I don't know that that's a guarantee.
That would be quite something. Because, like, he's not on the list of the best, like, defensemen I've seen at Michigan, who are sophomore Jack Johnson, freshman Jacob Truba, freshman John Merrill. That was a real disappointing one. Hmm. And, of course, sophomore Zach. You say it.
Zach Werenski.
Thank you. But he could get there, and all the potential in the world, and starting to tap into it, and super fun player.
Well, and they have, like, good compliments to him, too. I think Ciccone is a perfect compliment to him. And
yeah, a good stay-at-home guy. And Boak is a kind of a guy who will jump up in a rush, and that's much more natural for Michigan to deal with.
Hopefully he's all right.
It looked like a head thing, so he might be concussed, but I don't think he has a history of it, and I think he'd probably be good for this weekend. But
so when they were doing senior night stuff, it looked like people were pretty hesitant around one of his arms.
Oh.
So, but he wasn't. He was there. Yeah. So he was. I mean, it was reported he wasn't on the bench for pretty much the entire game, and yet he came out for senior activities, but was in hockey gear. So it wasn't like he was being gurneyed somewhere.
Right. I mean, if he is out, the nice thing is that Michigan has Griffin Luce, who's played a lot this year. And
yeah, he's played a lot, yeah.
I mean, he's Michigan's worst defenseman with the puck on his stick. There's no question about that.
Yeah.
But he's, you know, he's developed a lot this year. And, like, believe me, I've seen some Michigan teams where you get down to that last pairing and it's like, why did they give this guy a stick?
Yeah, so. I remember the Claire years, but.
I wasn't even – that's not even – they used to have a walk-on, like a guy who, like, transferred from Army, who was their sixth defenseman. This was during the Comer years. This was a long time ago. But not to date myself, too late. But, yeah, it's been encouraging. And, you know, Michigan had a real big bump both in record played and Corsi. And Mel has a track record of that. And the nice thing about Mel is that, like, okay, he got Tech to a respectable level immediately and then kind of hovered there for another couple of years. And then he had a second gear. So, you know, I very much look forward to that second gear. And I'm going to look forward to this tournament, too, because this is a wide-open tournament.
Yeah, I think that I would say that Michigan is, penalty kill aside, is probably the second-best team in the Big Ten. And I would say that Ohio State is probably number one. Michigan just has not matched up well against them. But outside of that, I mean, they've gone toe-to-toe with everyone, and you can see the improvement as they've played teams the first time in the fall and then the second time in the winter, and they've just gotten better. You know, like I said, the power play, you have to, or the penalty kill, you have to set aside. Power play is not great either, but the penalty kill you have to set aside. But you see the improvement in not only specific areas on the ice, but in how they play these different teams.
Yep, so encouraging so far, and hopefully they take care of business this weekend and we get to see them back in the tournament for only the second time in 6 years.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks for joining us, Dave.
Thank you.
Thanks for looking at your computer.
Mm-hmm.
Hey.
Always.
Zach Werenski.
Yeah.
Oh, you. That's
yeah. Come on.
Critical pronunciation. Yes. I apologize. Apologize profusely.
I also gave a strong opinion on Quinn Hughes.
It's true.
He's our defenseman on the podcast.
That's why we call it Aces Hockey Podcast.
Thank you for listening to the MCO podcast. I am Ace Ambender along with Brian Cook, and I must say these floaties have really improved my performance this afternoon.
Better than us!